Next case is 06-2340 Allen Minor and Associates, Inc. versus Robert E. Martin. Mr. Lillard.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Sam Lillard, and I represent the appellant in this case, Robert Martin. Your Honor, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. This court should not adopt unreasonable restrictions on competition through an overbroad interpretation of trade secrets. Customer information derived solely from an employee's casual memory, which is general information, should not be considered a trade secret under Ohio law for both policy reasons and reasons of statutory construction. Now, the Eighth District's decision in Michael Shore, also supported by its decision Ellison and Commonwealth Sanitation Company, should be the law of Ohio, because in each of those cases, which are dealing with very specific factual situations like the case at bar. And it helps to highlight the policy reasons by addressing what are those factual situations, those courts, and this issue. This
case. Counsel, is your argument here that any information that is derived from memory should be, because that's the decision here, whether the compilation of this customer list from memory violates the trade secret statute?
No, that is not my position. My position is focusing on a very narrow subset of information that is obtained by the employee, which is information about customers, as opposed to specialized information, which I would suggest the court treat differently, such as information about formulas or special processes. But in
so you're saying that there's no proprietary interest in a customer list?
That is correct. And the reason for it, there's a difference between, and let me jump to where we should draw the line. Here's my suggestion. I would suggest this court draw the line between protecting, perhaps rightly, specialized information, which is information about formulas, special processes, architectural drawings, and general information honestly obtained by the employee when he leaves, that includes customer information. And you can see this distinction, Your Honor, if you look at who owns the subject matter of that information. When an employee leaves with the formula for Pepsi or the formula for the Coke, clearly the subject matter, the ownership, is owned by the employer. The employer bought it, paid for it, secured it, maybe invented it.
Let me direct you to the definition of trade secret in Section D. They say financial information or listing of names, addresses, or telephone numbers.
That's correct, Your Honor. But there's two things with the statutory definition. The statutory definition requires, first, there has to be a trade secret, and then there has to be a misappropriation of that trade secret. And the statute defines misappropriation to include taking a trade secret by improper means. When an employee does not leave with anything other than his memory, honestly gained by his employment, he has not inappropriately gained any information. He has not misappropriated anything.
He didn't
anything.
Have permission to take that information. The crux here is the information. And it's not whether that information was on a computer disk or that information was on a piece of paper or the information was transported via this individual's memory. It's the examination of the information and the utilization of that information. That's what this statute is talking about.
It isn't. That statute is talking about protecting employers' property, not about regulating employees' memory when they simply leave their employment, which is really about regulating competition. And again, if you look at that distinction, an employer will own the secret of the formula that may be at issue in their mind. But when they leave with just general information about employment and including information about customers, the employer doesn't own the customer. Doesn't own the name of the customer, the address, the phone number, or any other of the contact information. What is the employer asking to protect here? They're asking to protect the relationship with that customer. The employer wants to maintain its business of that customer free from interference from other competitors. such as its now former employee. So really, when you're restricting that, you're restricting competition. You're not restricting property owned by the employer, such as a secret formula or a special process.
Where in the definition is the word property used in defining a trade secret?
It is not in Ohio Revised Code. However, it does imply that it's talking about property from the overall meaning of the statute. Because again, the statute suggests that first there has to be a taking by the employee.
A trade secret often is not property in the sense it's not tangible property. It's oftentimes information, is it not?
That's true, it can be. But in most situations, it's a physical taking. It's a physical taking of a list or a taking of a computer disk or a taking of a file. And most cases that blur that issue supporting the 10th District are, in fact, the 10th District decision itself in Marseille is a case where they took files, physically took files.
In your
and they
case,
had actually an agreement.
In your case of what, some 15 clients who your client took in contact, is that correct, about 15?
Did he take the client or did he simply walk out of the employment with knowledge he had honestly gained from
whatever
his employment?
You want to call it, whatever you want to call it, you had 15, correct?
Right.
What if your client, instead had taken 100 because he remembered 100?
What if he did?
What if he had a photographic memory and he could memorize a list of 1,000?
And if he did, that would, again,
so you're really coming down to not casual memory. You're saying a customer list is not protected.
Right. I am making a very fine distinction with this. The courts do that anyway. In fact, the 10th District, where they say memorized list is the same as a written list, is really blurring two scenarios. They're blurring one scenario where the employee honestly leaves his employment with nothing but his gained experience, honestly obtained, and an employee that engages either by taking something or engages in what the court is suggesting as studied memorization, where it was the ancient form of photocopying.
But conclusion really would require us to read out of what a trade secret is the customer list.
I think you can do that clearly from the statute, but you also note that the statute does require there has to be a trade secret and a misappropriation. Trade secrets, by definition, is a controlling of business ethics. The statute.
Counsel, what's the list of names and addresses and telephone numbers that wouldn't be a customer list? What could you suggest would fit that definition of a trade secret?
That would information that an employee leaves with?
Yeah.
Well, what is it really that's at issue here? It's the fact that the employee, when he left with a relationship, too, that he built
no,
with the
counsel,
employer.
No, the question I'm asking you, that you want us to read out of this definition of trade secret a customer list, okay? So the statute, as derived, established here by the General Assembly, puts in a trade secret means information, et cetera, or information which could consist of listing of names, addresses, or telephone numbers that satisfies both of the following. It derives an independent economic value. There's no doubt that a customer list is a value. And your client would derive economic value from its disclosure or use. And it's the subject of efforts that are reasonable under the circumstances to maintain secrecy. And that, I think, is in the eye of the owner, the original established entity that established the list. So that, to me, clearly states a customer list that is developed by the employer and taken by an employee, whether by memory or disk or paper. You're saying that we need to carve out an exception here and say that customer lists aren't a trade secret. Then what is a listing of names, addresses, and telephone numbers?
No, I'm not necessarily suggesting you carve out customer lists in total. I'm talking about a specific type of information, which is general information as exposed to specific. An employee leaves with this general. I'm talking
about.
Give
me an example.
Okay. An example would be if an employee takes a physical customer list, something that is owned by the employer.
Which is names, addresses, and telephone numbers.
Which
how to contact
the client
them.
In Mesarvi did in 10th District. He took it, right? In a number of other cases where they fall for the 10th District, they take something physically. That is part of the trade secrets because it's a property owned by the employer.
So okay? If he memorizes it, he's okay.
If he gauges in studied memorization, I'm okay with that also falling into trade secrets because, again, that's the employee using the ancient form of photocopying, using his memory to do something, take something that's not his, and to use it later. But that is not these cases. This is a case where employee simply leaves.
How do we set the standard of where casual memory ends and somebody actually memorizes and studies it, and somebody who has a photographic memory, which is casual for him?
You do it based on statutory construction, because the statute requires there to be a trade secret, like the customer list, and a misappropriating of that trade secrets. That is, a trade secret acquired by improper means. So it's an improper means to steal a physical list that doesn't belong to you. It's improper means, I would suggest, to engage in that studied memorization, which are not these cases.
Counsel,
yes, Your Honor.
Help me distinguish in my mind a situation in which maybe the law practice isn't comparable, I don't know. But let's say in your business with your client, did your client have a segment of customers that he particularly provided services for?
That is correct.
And were the folks who he ended up with after he left, were those all folks that he had been their personal contact?
Yes. Through his employment with them, with his employment with the employer, he developed relationships with them. They became aware of him. They liked him. He became aware of their ways of business. Yes.
So none of this group that is involved in this litigation were people that he hadn't previously done one-on-one service with?
That's correct. That is correct. And that raises the policy issue. If an employer wishes to protect, because that's really what the employer is trying to protect here, not the information about their names or addresses, that's all public. What he's trying to protect is the relationship that he had, that he can protect through a non-compete agreement. This court shouldn't have to draw that line. The employer and the employee should draw that line. They can enter into a non-compete agreement or a non-solicitation agreement.
Well, that's the difficulty I'm having. I'm having trouble buying into your, he remembered it instead of carrying a list out the door, and it seems to me the important distinction for us to worry about is was there some unique personal relationship that meant the client, if your client was going to be open for business down the street, that these people would necessarily want to follow him because that's who they trusted, that's who they knew.
That's correct. And if an employer wishes
I'm not trying to make your argument or I'm asking you to help us draw some distinctions in that regard instead of whether or not he remembered certain names and phone numbers. Presumably it wouldn't be hard to remember the names of the people that he was dealing with.
No, in fact, in this case, it's not even secret. It's public record. It's on a Form 5500. It can be asked by the Freedom of Information Act, and it can even be got upon by...
The Court of Appeals pretty well knocked down that argument.
Right, but it's really that he's trying to protect the relationship. But in the policy reasons, perhaps it can be better looked at in looking at the opposite. If we don't create that distinction between someone taking a physical list or someone engaging in memory, engaging in inappropriate acts, but simply freely leaving their employment honestly with experience honestly gained, then aren't we really creating a de facto non-compete agreement that, one, the parties never bargained for, and two, has no reasonable limits. In fact, has no limits at all on
but
duration.
But that's a policy question that the General Assembly has addressed with a statute.
Right.
The trade secrets.
And I would agree that they have. And they have by requiring that the trade secret before the Ohio Uniform Trade Secret Act's protections kick in, that it must be a trade secret that has been misappropriated. That is, has been acquired by quote-unquote improper means. When an employee simply leaves his employment with
your
nothing
your case comes to us as a certified conflict, but the conflict jurisdictions are decided under the common law, and this case is decided under the statutory law. So is there really a conflict here?
There is. There's a clear conflict.
Help me with that.
And the conflict is between the 10th District, who simply says that, look, they make a simple analysis. If it's a written list is the same as a memorized list. And what they're doing is, again, blurring a distinction between an employee taking a physical list or engaging in improper acts of the studied memorization and someone simply leaving his employment.
So if your client
had... district is saying we're not going there because, one, it's not a trade secret.
If your client had written down these names and put them in a folder and then walked out with it, then you'd say that would be a violation.
Then that engages in that improper conduct that triggers the protection of the Ohio Uniform Trade Secrets Act.
All right.
But
well,
not
counsel,
here.
What if he had his own PDA and he put the names and addresses in there himself? Didn't take a document, didn't take a computer disk or anything. He just happened to walk out into the hallway and put in a name and address of a client. What's the, what is that wrong?
I would suggest to this court that taking customer information when there's no non-compete agreement, no solicitation agreement, is really simply restricting competition.
Okay, so
it is not
I'm a little
wrong.
Confused about what's your best argument here? I mean, we're hearing non-compete agreement wasn't present. We hear that memory's different from a piece of paper. What's your best argument here that is going to...
The best argument is this court and the Ohio court should not be protecting employers who refuse to protect themselves, meaning that the employers, if they wish to regulate this information, they can condition employment with a non-compete agreement or a non-solicitation agreement.
Where does the statute, where does the statute say that? You're asking us to create some totally new concept here that the General Assembly has had an opportunity and will certainly have an opportunity to address.
No, the statute does not say
argument?
Your Honor. It does not. And in fact, that's simply the policy argument that's behind, I think, this statute. Again, the statute itself, though, does contain the words misrepresentation. That is what the legislature has placed in it, and it is defined misrepresentation, again, as acquiring that information by improper means.
You just used the word information. The thrust of the statute is information.
Trade secrets, it, Your Honor. Sorry.
Right. And it doesn't distinguish between a person with a very good memory and a person who has to write everything down, does it? The statute doesn't distinguish
it
between
doesn't,
those
It doesn't, but
two.
It does make a distinction between moral culpable conduct and employees simply leaving with their experience honestly gained. That's where the distinction is, and that's where the 8th District made this distinction.
You can leave with the experience. It's just a question
not.
Of who, with whom you share it.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
You can leave with the experience, obviously, but the question is with whom can you share it?
Right. Well, this court has already indicated, absent a non-compete agreement or agreement otherwise, once an employee leaves his employer, he's free to compete, including compete against the customers that he used to work with when he was an employee for that employer. That's the nature of our employment relationship here in Ohio, and that is allows free competition. And I
noticed one more question. In the appellate court's decision, it says that the trial court determined that the client list was an intangible asset and that AMA had devoted considerable time and resources over a 20-year period to establish, and also it took sufficient precautionary measures to assure that the client list remained confidential, including informing its employees that the client information was confidential and not to be made public, circulating the computer usage policy, again, emphasizing that this was confidential, not to be made public, and were not to be removed from the confines of the office, and then securing client information from these from those entering the office. So if the findings of the trial court here that are adopted by the appellate court, that the employer took all measures to establish this as confidential information, you're saying that even though it may be classified as confidential information, because it was carried out in his memory as opposed to physically carrying out, that makes a difference?
It does. He didn't take anything from his employer.
Okay.
The magistrate points out he left nothing but his memory, and in fact, he left his Rolodex there that he brought with him to avoid the appearance of impropriety. That is the difference. In fact, he never violated that those rules with the employer. He never took any computer data, any list of any type. He simply left with his experience.
You've used your time, Mr. Lillard.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Waller.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. Common sense dictates that a trade secret doesn't lose its trade secret status because it's carried out in somebody's head. The statute doesn't talk about memory, doesn't talk about written items. It just talks about trade secrets. Mr. Lillard.
Counsel, let's assume we're persuaded of that. What's left in this case for us to decide? The Court of Appeals cites to the Plain Dealer case, in which the Chief Justice wrote and adopted, in addition to the statute, six factors to be analyzed.
Is your question?
Was that analysis done by the trial court or not, as to whether or not this, in fact, was a trade secret?
It was, and one of the difficulties with this case, when the magistrate's decision was issued, the transcript was in order. There was no transcript of the trial in this case. You won't see it in the record because it's not there. The trial court and the magistrate's factual findings, therefore, under Civil Rule 53, are the facts of this case. They did go through that analysis, and the magistrate did find that AMA did comply with 133361.
Let's jump to Justice O'Donnell's question then, whether or not there really is a conflict here.
I argued in the Court of Appeals, and I lost, that there's really no conflict, which is really troubling to me with the 8th District, and I think it was the 6th District cases. When you look at them, especially the Michael Shoren Company versus Greenwald case, which is the case where the conflict supposedly arose, the Court of Appeals in that case held, and I quote, "A review of the trial court's memorandum reveals that it made no finding regarding the use of trade secrets or confidential information." It wasn't even a finding in the case. And I'd also suggest that in the casual memory cases, if you go examine all the casual memory cases, most of which I believe come out of the state of New York, there's a theme in those. Either the courts held that the information was readily available to the public, therefore wasn't a trade secret, or the employee did something wrong.
I guess what's concerning me is if we write on this and you prevail, the danger that we create an inappropriate or unfair burden on someone leaving a firm, going down the street, whether it's accounting or law or actuarial assistance, and who was not subject to a non-compete clause, and servicing people with whom they had a personal relationship. They're the reason the client came in the door in the first place.
That certainly could be a concern, but in this case, and in all cases, there's nothing that prohibits Mr. Martin from sending out 25,000 letters to every company in the state of Ohio saying, here's what I do, I open my doors. Call me if you want. Nothing wrong with that.
Can he personalize a letter to the folks that he was face to face with?
I would suggest
I've left.
I would suggest that the only way he could do that was with a general solicitation. I've left, and here's my business. But what he did in this case and what the exhibit shows, it was the defendant's exhibits, the letters he sent out. And one of the keys here is, I am offering annual administrative fees for the 2002 plan year, and I will provide these services at 90% of what you paid last year. There was nothing personal about what he did.
Yeah, and I'm guessing, but you're saying the factual underpinning here isn't even in the record to help us out.
It is not. And I would suggest there's no burden on an employee who leaves having trade secrets in his head. He can still work. He just can't work for the clients for whom he worked if those names and contact information was a trade secret. Just the same way he couldn't go make Coca-Cola.
So I think what's key is that a court make a finding that there is a trade secret, and then that list, whether memorized or not, can't be taken versus just general customers. You know, you have 20 homes in a city, and you write all 20 homes because they all have gutters and need gutter guards.
Absolutely. Like, and an easy example, which isn't in the record, but it's a case I've been involved in, it was with fire restoration folks. Their clients are insurance adjusters. Easy to get that information. You go by the directory of the trade. There's all their names, who they work for, and their address. There's nothing trade secret about it. But in this case, there was a hearing, there was a trial, and determinations made by the trial court that this was, in fact, a trade secret.
I want to come back to the last thing you said just before you answered Justice Stratton's question, and that was he just can't do work for any of the people that he was servicing before. And that's what's troubling to me. And if that's really where you want us to go, that is imposing a non-compete clause.
That really didn't happen here, and unfortunately there is no transcript. There was a few clients for whom AMA was seeking damages. As it turned out, those clients found Mr. Martin where he was and did business with him. Mr. Martin did not use the trade secret information to go to them. There's absolutely nothing improper about
that. Can you help us by suggesting how we would draw the line if we were writing a case coming out the way you would like us to come out that still allows the opportunity for a lawyer, an accountant, an insurance agent, you name it, who decides it's time for me to pay my own rent, have my own secretary,
to
have some contact with the people with whom they had a personal relationship to make them aware, I'm now on a different street corner?
I would say that a general solicitation letter, or a general informational letter, not a solicitation letter, that says, "Dear ABC, I have left the employ of AMA. Here's my telephone and number." If those people call,
and I'm now providing the full service.
Correct.
Da, 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 da.
Especially going so far as saying that I'll cut the rate by 10%.
Yeah.
I would suggest that the focus of this court should be not the manner in which the information's taken, but the trade secret nature of the information, and whether it's taken by memory, by stealing a list, by putting information into a PDA, it's irrelevant. It's a trade secret under 133361. And it's subject to protection. One other comment I'd like to make, there is no requirement under 1331 or 133361 that requires a bad act to misappropriate. The statute's clear in subsection 2B. If the information was acquired under circumstances giving rise to a duty to maintain its secrecy or limits its use, that can be misappropriation. I would suggest that in the facts of this case, the certified question should be answered in the affirmative, and that a memorized customer list is subject to a statutory trade secret violation.
There's a second proposition of law which you addressed, the internet issue.
I can address that.
Can you address it in terms of suggesting a standard we might develop on that issue?
I don't know that you can come out with a broad standard. It's a factual determination under 133361 whether or not the information is readily accessible. If, for example, I'll go back to the insurance adjuster example I used before. In that case, I got on the internet and I put in insurance adjusters, fire restoration. I came up with a list in Columbus, Ohio in 10 seconds. In this case, and again, unfortunately, there's no transcript, what's not in the record is when Mr. Martin did that using the freeerisa.com, he came up with only six of Mr. Miner's 500 clients, none of whom were the ones he solicited. And the trial court found, factually, the names were not readily ascertainable. So I don't think that you can come out with a rule of law that finds what readily ascertainable is. Some are easier found than others. Others might take 5 years to find. Readily ascertainable to me means pretty quickly and easily. Not certainly.
Well, and it would presumably mean not in a needle on a haystack kind of thing.
Right. All the names are in the phone book.
Right. I take it this internet access here did not disclose. It would be an entirely different matter, would it not, if you could pull this up with an input of the right questions and get Al Miner's entire client list identified as such. In other words, they indexed them. These people are getting this service provided by this provider.
Sure, that would be readily ascertainable and easily done.
And if that were available, you wouldn't have much of a case.
Wouldn't have a trade secret.
Yeah.
And we wouldn't be here today. No, there would just be no trade secret under the statute because the information's in the public domain, readily ascertainable. If the court has no further questions, I'd urge you to affirm the 10th District. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Waller. Mr. Lillard, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
Your Honor, there is no disputed fact in this case at all. And going to the question that the court had asked about the relationships, the 10th District's decision would prevent competition from the class of former employees. Now, that may not be a big policy issue with this particular small employer, but for a large employer, such as
Well,
Nationwide.
Don't they say, they sort of touch on that by saying, they suggest that could be a problem.
A big problem.
But it's not a problem here because Al Miner didn't ask for your client be enjoined. And so we're not addressing it. So they sort of swept that issue aside and said we're not forced to deal with it.
Well, we must be forced to deal with that because if we do not, if we adopt the 10th District's decision, we are going to be creating a limitation on competition for an entire set of competitors. And that set is all former employees of a employer.
Well, it'll counsel, open the floodgates of litigation. What about the solution that was identified, that if you are a former employer, that you would make known to the public or to the entire list of similarly situated businesses that you're attempting to gain business from that, here's my new location, you know, love to see you. Take out an ad in the newspaper, an ad in a trade journal. Make your identification known in that way as opposed to singling out individuals and offering, you know, solicitation based on prior acquired information.
Yes, Your Honor. Restrict this pension analyst from methods of competing for those customers and not restrict all the other individuals who were not former employees.
They could all use the same method. He's not restricted from competition if there's a general announcement that I'm in business for myself right now.
Auto dealers and a lot of other individuals out there that are competing for those customers know
it's not
that
a customer
the effectiveness
list. You're not going from a customer list when you're an auto dealer. You might go to the Bureau of Motor Vehicles, but you're not doing that's non-proprietary. We're talking about something that's identified as a trade secret, and the solution that's been identified is a very simple one that I think ensures competition and is not a betrayal of the former employer's trade secret.
But still, Your Honor, isn't there a difference between the former employer, which is Al Miner Associates, having the right to directly solicit customers, and the former employee who is now restricted on those solicitations, and then all the other pension analysts out there that are not restricted? Doesn't that give some employers unfair advantage or some employees unfair advantage over others? It does. Again, if you have a large corporation like Nationwide or like Cardinal Health, where you have a number of former employees, you're going to be restricting them through the guise of trade secrets from competing for that set of customers, which is what is being done here. So that's why this is really a issue about non-competition. And it would really unfairly limit competition if we don't make the distinction that we're suggesting in the court. Thank you, Your Honor. So we'd ask.
Thank you, Mr. Lillard. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.